Hey, this is Rob Johnson. Now that the legislative session has kicked off, I heard some folks talking about a new blog, something called the Texas Tribune. Apparently it has charts and graphs and even videos of cats playing the piano. I hope they aren't being paid for listener, but I guess they also have a podcast. So buckle your seatbelts. Here it comes.
Well, thanks, Rob. This is Ben Philpott here filling in for Reeve Hamilton while he's on a gypsy sabbatical. But, you know, Rob, I'm pretty sure
that's... Is that what they're calling
it? I think that's what it is. You know, Rob, I'm pretty sure that's what you told the press corps just before we went into South Carolina back in January.
Buckle your seatbelts.
Unfortunately, they couldn't...
A year later, and he's still mean about the presidential race.
Unfortunately, they couldn't afford seatbelts in the press van at that point, I believe. But, you know, or maybe they didn't want to spend the money. I don't know. It was the press van.
At some point, he's being mean about the next presidential race.
Yeah. I think they only didn't have a seatbelt for Jay.
Oh, well, that's right. Quite possible. They knew about the diary.
Right.
Anyway, again, I'm Ben Philpott from KUT and the Texas Tribune. Thanks for tuning in this week or whatever you do on your podcast there. I'm with the some of the usual gang, Evan Smith, editor-in-chief and CEO of the Texas Tribune.
You really sound like you've never done this before. It's kind of great.
I get that after everything I do at KUT.
We are a radio professional. That's how about right. that?
Executive editor Ross Ramsey.
Howdy.
And Aman Bathija, who reports on all kinds of stuff. You did a lot
of stuff. Bathija.
I said that, didn't
I? Know.
I?
I'm just making something. Everybody hears it. Bathija. Pronounce it right.
Aman Bathija.
He's very protective of me.
Well, it should be. You know, we're surprised you survived the Senate race. But I don't know.
What the hell are you talking about?
Welcome to Ben Philpott's Internal
Dialogue. I feel like Sinfronia last session. You know, I can't believe I'm saying this, but I miss Reeve. You
know? That's going to be his new ringtone.
That's it.
I should have that. That'd be great. We've started a session, and we're now on to week 1.5. Of course, we worked 2 full days this week.
It was
so
exhausting.
We're now,
so they're taking a week off.
They're taking a week off.
It's unbelievable.
But lots of things to talk about. You know, do we want to go ahead and start with the news that the Tribune kind of made this week? Or
well, I don't know that we made news. I think that we presented an app that
you presented some
amazing
news.
The financial interests of 180 members of the legislature, and the response was predictable. We got some.
Well, some of it was. I mean, the response from the people that we were listing was predictable. The response from people outside was, you know, sort of.
Well, positive.
This is pretty great.
It's a great tool. And it's the result of 9 months of reporting, and 20 reporters had their hands on this in one form or another. And the upshot is, in one place now, you know more about the financial interests of elected officials than you did before. And we think that's a public service, blah-de-dee-blah-de-dee-blah.
Well, and so. For those people that haven't heard about this yet or haven't had a chance to visit it on the blog, as Rob Johnson says, what are they going to find? Kind of in a nutshell, what are the 3 or 4 highlights you're going to find when you hit these sites, when you can pick any of the lawmakers, and what are you going to find?
The idea here is that lawmakers have to disclose, to some extent, it's sort of sloppy, but they have to disclose their personal financial interests. And the idea is, when you see them vote or you see them do the things that they do here in Austin, are they acting on their own behalf, or are they acting on behalf of the people that they represent? And you only know that if you know what it is, what their personal interests are. So you can see so-and-so vote and say, well, he or she owns stock and blah, blah, blah. Maybe they're voting for themselves. Or maybe they're just voting against their own interest and they're voting for their constituents. You don't know how they're voting or why they're voting the way they're voting until you can see what all of the things that influence them are, what their financial interests are,
who their pals are, all
of that kind of stuff.
Top campaign contributors.
So they disclose some of this, but they make it very difficult to get to. The disclosure laws are weak, so they can disclose, instead of saying, you know, I have $27,000 worth of stock in, you know, Intergalactic Garage Tech. It says I own somewhere between $25,000 and $2 million worth of stock. Could be anything, right? But within those constraints, they report their ownership of stocks, of businesses, of real estate, and some other things. And they put it on these things called personal financial statements. They file them with the Texas Ethics Commission, which is not allowed to publish them. And they file them
because
on
of
PDFs.
Kidnappers, I believe.
Well, you know, but that's a very
important distinction. It's not just that the disclosure laws are weak, but the accessibility that the average person has, you know, to these forms has been completely diminished by the unwillingness of people to give access, ready access to this stuff.
I mean, right.
If we believe in open government, then you'd think that this sort of stuff would be readily available to the average person, and it isn't.
If you live in El Paso, you have to drive to Austin and go request it.
During work
correct?
Hours yeah. and go to the Sam Houston State right. Office Building and blah, blah, blah. So the first thing we did was we went and got all those forms ourselves and put them online. The second thing we did, and this is what we've unveiled this week, is we read them. And put them well.
Took
I mean,
us 3 years it, apparently.
This is something.
I believe mean, that's why these, the suicide rate in the newsroom went
these
up.
Things, some of these things are 20 pages long. Some of these things are 140 pages long.
I mean, some of them are 5 pages.
Yeah. Well. That, yeah. But so we read them and put all of the sort of the big information into a spreadsheet, and then did interviews and all kinds of stuff. And the idea is that you can go look up your state representative and find out something about their personal financial interests and their business interests and their business associations and those kinds of things, so that you can assess whether they're doing the job you sent them here to do.
Well, and I like the little part that you have at the bottom on them with the analysis of it, pointing out, yes, they've been committee chair here or they've been on this committee here. And if you notice down, what, as you saw in the stock holdings, there's actually, could be considered a conflict in this area. This is, different complaints that have been filed in the past. I think being able to pull it together and not everyone can just look at that little thumbnail and say, well, I see the conflict.
Part of this, Ben, that I'm particularly interested in is the degree to which the income sources of spouses and children are not disclosed by members.
Right.
We're trying to get at as much of that as possible. But if you find out that Senator X or Representative Y has a child in an industry and the member is on the committee that regulates that industry.
Right.
The member may say, well, I'm not directly benefiting from the work I do, but it's, to my mind, it's still something that the public, the voters, the constituents have a right to know, should want to know.
Yeah, I mean, the voters can look at this stuff and say, look, I don't think that there's actually a conflict there. I think that, my representative or my senator is completely honest about this. But it ought to be disclosed so that the constituent can actually look at that and make that assessment.
Well, just for sheer ridiculousness, I enjoyed looking at all the different homes and bits of
property
that,
values.
They owned. I thought that was, that's
voyeuristic,
right? Yeah.
Well, there's always
kind of awesome in its own way,
right? There's always that element of it, and then behind this project's called Business as Usual, and behind this, we're going to report on some of this stuff and talk about how these laws might hide things, how these laws might allow them to hide things, what the relationships are, why are there so many insurance people on the insurance committee, all of those kinds of things.
Yeah.
We'll do that, throughout the session.
In fact, we've already begun to report on it, and one interesting thing that happened, I don't want to say it's as a result of the work we did, but the timing coincidentally is right in line with the launch of this project, is that two freshman members, Giovanni Capriglione, who beat Vicky Truitt in the primary last year, he's from South Lake
right. Mm-hmm.
And then Mary Gonzalez from El Paso, who took Chente Quintanilla's seat,
right,
joined forces to introduce a piece of legislation yesterday, Tuesday, as you're listening to this, of this week, that would strengthen the disclosure laws, would require greater disclosure on the part of members.
Right, and what it requires is that members report contracts between the state and any member of their family. So if your wife or husband...
So it gets at the spouse or kid problem.
If your wife or husband or child has a state income that you might be voting on when you vote on the budget, your voters ought to know that.
Well, and the state or any public entity, I think.
It may be any public entity. And the fact is, to Aman, with Aman Bethija...
I hear that, yes.
Sitting here, after the Capriglione-Gonzalez bill was filed, Wendy Davis in the Senate, Democrat from Fort Worth... filed a piece of companion legislation that was an interesting bit in view of the reporting, Aman, on last year's Senate race.
Yes, Wendy wouldn't reveal her public clients, even though she's got a bunch of them
in
her
district.
She's a lawyer, and she works for a lot of public entities. Through just searching through public documents, we were able to find out about DFW Airport, Benbrook Water District, the Fort Worth ISD. But she wouldn't reveal all of them to us, and she said it was attorney-client privilege. And I pointed out that a lot of these are already in public documents. I can't look at every public entity's documents and search for your name. Can you just tell me them? And she said she just kept saying attorney-client privilege. But it appears that if she's sponsoring this law, then she's okay revealing it if the law makes her. She just feels like she can't until
she filed legislation that she would herself be subject to. There was some question for a while yesterday whether the percentage of the firm's clients hit the threshold cited in the legislation, and it turns out it does, and that her office says specifically that she would now be subject to disclosure under this law of the client she's previously been unwilling to disclose. You know, we've popped her for not being adequately transparent in the past. Let's give her at least in the abstract credit for being willing to own this thing. That's pretty
You can hide a lot of stuff under the shingle lawyer, and you can hide a lot of stuff under the shingle consultant, and it's not always nefarious. Like, if I were a criminal defense lawyer and I was a legislature, some of my clients come to me and say, listen, you need to keep me out of trouble, so I'm hiring you to keep me out of the grand jury room. They don't really want their name revealed, and they rely on their attorney-client privilege to keep their name secret. I mean, you have to respect that. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, it's possible to hire a legislator and basically, if you wanted to commit a crime here, you could hire a legislator, hide behind the attorney-client privilege, and pay them while they're passing legislation that's beneficial to you.
And you'd never know about it. And the reality is, as Molly Ivins or somebody before Molly said, it's often attributed to Molly, the crime here, to the degree that there is one, isn't what's illegal, it's what's legal.
Right.
This week, both Emily in the New York Times, our own Emily Ramshaw in the New York Times and the Tribune, and then sort of coincidentally Patty Hart in the Houston Chronicle, observed that one interesting perk that legislators who happen to be lawyers enjoy is the ability to ask for continuances repeatedly in cases where they're representing folks.
Right.
And, that's not something that the average individual has access to.
They can all lawyers can ask for continuances, but judges have to give them to legislators.
Wasn't that, isn't it the whole thing of that's why big law firms hire lawmakers so they can put cases that they're not ready to lawmaker?
They did pass some legislation in 2003 that limits this to some extent, but it doesn't outlaw it. Yeah. It just makes them report it.
It's permissible. Now, we can talk about something else if you want. Yeah. I think the interesting thing here in the end is going to be we're not looking to bust people so much as we are looking to shine a bright light on business as usual, which we call now business as usual.
Right.
We're looking to shine a bright light on this so that people are more aware of the way that government works.
And
we're not necessarily calling people out for doing things illegally. We're calling them out for doing things legally. The problem is not what's illegal. The problem is what's legal.
Well, and how now different Tea Party members have called and thanked you this week, I'm assuming.
We've had calls from all over the spectrum.
Interestingly, this is an area where the far left and the far right agree on very little, but they both don't believe they're being told the whole story.
Capriglione and Gonzalez could not be more different politically.
You couldn't imagine. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
they're freshmen. They're from different ends of the state. They're from different ends of the political spectrum, and they are in 100% accord on this thing.
It ought to be something that everybody can get behind. So.
Right.
That's right. Well, let's move on to other things that have happened over the last few days at the legislature.
I want Amon to explain the damn budget.
Okay.
Yeah, what the heck? You've read it, right?
Is that why we brought him in?
Thing?
Okay.
Yeah, all 800 pages.
So we've had a House version and a Senate version filed. They both appear to be very similar to the 2009 budgets. What do we have? What are the high points?
2009 here? Or 2011?
2009.
The 2009.
Spending level,
But similar in the sense that the expenses imagined on things like public ed and everything, you're not seeing because of the surplus some kind of massive increase.
Oh, no.
It's really almost charitable to call these budgets because both in the Senate and the House, they basically said, we've ignored a lot of our expenses and we didn't account for a lot of inflation. And basically, we're just going to let the lawmakers figure out what they want to do. And so they kind of the phrase I kept hearing over and over again is this is a starting point.
So they just threw a framework up and said go.
Right. But the frameworks are a little different. And where they're different is kind of interesting. Like on Medicaid, neither of them account for the cost of delivering Medicaid getting more expensive over the next 2 years.
Which is not in question, right? That's going to happen.
Right.
Yeah. No one's denying that. They just they don't account for it.
And they even decide populations differently. I mean, one of them is 2013, the other one's 2015 population.
The Senate version assumes that no one's going to join Medicaid after this August. The House version does...
Poverty eradicated. That's it.
I think that's secession.
But then there's like the governor's economic incentive programs. Both budgets don't add any new funding to them.
So they don't obliterate them. They just don't put any more money into them.
Right. But so like Texas Enterprise Fund has like $120 million left. They leave it there.
Right.
But the Texas Film Incentives Program has no money left, and they don't give them any. They just give them money to basically keep the office running.
I see.
They also take out the money for the major event, or not take out, but they don't add any more money to the major events program. Although right. there's been apparently I was hearing there's been a little bit of a discussion over whether or not that actually affects the major events program, because it was supposed to be self-funding after the first round of grants were sent out, something about collecting tax dollars from the events to then replenish the fund. But, you know, that's the one that brought Formula One racing to Austin.
Right.
So yeah, no film incentives, and the big pot of money that brought Formula One to Austin are gone. So Austin, as usual, is being beaten up in the...
So how much money do they have? Do you have a sense yet of how much money they have? You know, they throw up these budgets. Their overall cost is about the same as the total cost of the 2009 budget. How much money do they have that they can add to that, you know, according to the controller and everything? I mean, if they wanted to spend all of the money that's available right now, how much bigger can those budgets get?
Well, they have to spend about almost $7 billion on a supplemental budget, basically paying for bills from the last session that they did.
Medicaid and the school deferral.
Right, and firefighting, forest fire, wildfire.
Medical care and prison system.
Yeah, those are the big four. So it's almost $7 billion to pay for that.
And they can't pay for that out of current revenue?
They can, yes.
They can, but it doesn't make a difference. It's one pair of pants in multiple pockets, right?
They ended the current budget. The controller says they'll end the current budget with $8.8 billion left. So the $7 billion, presumably $7 billion, whatever, presumably
right.
come out of that.
Right. And the controller said there was about $101 billion, right. I think, in the estimate. So once you take out that and the base budgets they offered were $89 billion. So once you figure that out, I think it's about $5 billion left is what I've heard. And then there's the rainy day fund.
Which could be $11 billion by 2015.
11 or $12 billion, yeah. So there's a lot of money there. And so what really the fight seems to be, Essentially, is not over what to cut, but what to fix. There's transportation, there's water, and then there's a school finance lawsuit, which is the really weird part.
And in my view, maybe in your view as well, water seems to be the one that people are focusing on first. Right, first and foremost. We're hearing about an intention to take money potentially out of the
rainy day. It appears to be the one where the argument...
Rainy day fund is a one-time withdrawal on the Senate side. Ritter is talking about a similar deal on the House side. Mm-hmm. Water seems to be, again, a rare moment in bipartisanship, and that everybody seems to agree that the problem needs to be...
They're going to argue on how much instead of whether or not.
Yeah, but even the plans so far don't seem to do very much. I mean, it's $1 billion on the Senate side or so, and $2 billion on the House side.
Yeah, the question, you know, one of the questions is, how do you use the billion, and can you use it to borrow? And if you use it to borrow, how much money can you leverage out of the billion?
Yeah.
The cautionary note on that is, you know, didn't we just borrow a bunch of money on highways? Are we going to do that again?
And that's not worked out so well, right?
Well, I mean, it's worked out okay, but, you know, you've run up the state's debt.
That's the best one I'm saying. You run up the state's debt in the course of doing it.
You're to a point with, Amon knows these numbers better than I do, but you're to the point with transportation where the money raised in various taxes and fees for transportation is no longer sufficient to cover maintenance on the roads we've already built.
Leaving aside the question of more roads.
Leaving aside more roads and leaving aside debt service on the borrowing that we've made to build the roads that we're building now.
TxDOT has said they basically need about $4 billion more beyond what the base budget is just to kind of keep up with congestion and maintenance. And I think the reason that transportation isn't getting quite as much attention as water is because the argument in transportation is, do we just throw money at it or do we raise some fee? Or to get
well, there's also an alternate revenue source for paying for roads, and that's tolling, which you've written about extensively. In the case of water, there's not an alternate revenue source, although
they've talked about a tax
on bottled water. They've talked about a tap fee, which Chairman Ritter has attempted before, and I suspect will attempt again. We'll have him by the time you hear this. He may have already been at TribLive, and you know we'll know whether or not that's going to be a
The cities are kicking back on that.
On the tap tax,
because a lot of the water comes from city utilities, and they're saying that's a mandated fee. Blah blah blah.
So. Nobody wants to, all right, fine, and let's give them the benefit of the doubt and say, okay, they have a legitimate point in objecting to this. The problem is, no is not a solution to this problem, and if everybody objects to every potential thing proposed. This is, you know, you get in your car, you drive to the store, there's a road on which to drive. In some communities, they turn on the faucet, there's nothing coming out. I mean, the problem is more immediate and more noticeably immediate in the case of water. Somebody's going to have to give on this.
Right, and that's been the big problem with the 50-year water plan in the last few sessions is there have been different funding mechanisms put out there, passed by the Senate usually, and then... Nothing happens.
I still wonder, this is something that Kate Galbraith, our great reporter on water, and other people who've studied this more in a more detailed fashion than I have said. as well as people outside of journalism, people who actually know something, like Andy Sansom at the Meadows Center down at Texas State. The problem is not just that we don't have the funding on water. It's that the plan, which was written several years ago, mm-hmm. and assumes that we're going to engineer our way out of the problem by building a bunch of reservoirs, acquiring land right. and right-of-way and building reservoirs and then acquiring more land and more right-of-way and building pipeline from where the water is to where the water needs to be. That may be the wrong plan today. There may be higher-tech solutions to the problem that may be more cost efficient. The plan itself, which we talked about, $53 billion unfunded, that may just not be what ultimately we do. So I think that the issue is very much in flux, but the biggest problem, first and foremost, is whatever the solution is, it's going to cost something.
I think this, you know, my prediction of this is that the political thing is going to come to the fore kind of in the form of the battles of St. Augustine. You know, we're going to be fighting in suburbs over how long and how much you can water your grass. And that becomes a political problem for suburban Republicans and for others. And I think that that's kind of the water equivalent of, hey, I'm stuck in traffic, what are you doing about it? And you know, we've already had some skirmishes here and there, but if you can water your lawn three times a week in Arlington and you turn on the faucet in Spicewood and nothing comes out, you've clearly got to do something here.
It'll just be interesting to see if anybody can finally have the appetite for a funding mechanism. I mean, it's like we had this with roads a couple sessions back. I think they threw up 7 or 8 different funding mechanisms to increase TxDOT funding, and every single one of them was knocked down. Local option or a gas tax or, you know, and
the tendency is only to do this when the alternative is a worse political consequence, right? So I don't want to vote for taxes, but I'll vote for taxes if the courts are ordering me to raise taxes or close the schools.
Well, and that's what's happening right? with the school finance lawsuit.
Right, that's exactly right. So, and that's why the legislature doesn't really act on school finance except when the courts say, okay, you got it. The okay, you got it here is getting stronger for water. Question is whether it's strong enough.
Let me suggest that the success of Mayor Castro in San Antonio passing the 1/8 cent sales tax increase to pay for full day pre-K and the success of Senator Watson in pushing for and passing the tax increase to fund the medical school, I think those two instances, I think, are potentially interesting for this conversation, because if the legislature fails to act adequately on this problem, what's to stop another mayor or another senator right. from getting behind a plan locally to raise taxes locally to fund some kind of innovations in water? Storage or water conservation or something.
But the problem there is who's minding the constituency of the rice farmers downstream on the Colorado. I mean, you have Kirk Watson here in Austin, but he's not going to try to help
Glenn Hager to jump up and down on that pretty quick.
He's not going to get the city. But they're talking about these reservoirs that would be at different points on the Colorado all the way down. I mean, there's not like one municipality that you would come to and say, help us to.
So it's not as if there's a single member or single jurisdiction.
But that's the other problem here, is that these all cross, all of these water areas cross district lines, mm-hmm. you know. So Dallas gets its water from East Texas. Houston gets its water from, you know.
And I mean, more Democrat San Antonio and more Democrat Austin kind of joining together to come up with something. But, you know, what are you going to do in other parts of the state?
You know, in Irving, they're talking about getting water from Oklahoma. I mean, you cross so many jurisdictional lines that you have to have help.
It's come to this.
Right. we're asking Oklahoma for help.
It's so bad.
We're currently begging right. Oklahoma for water and fighting New Mexico.
OU may suck, but H2OU, we're fine with that, actually.
That's a good one.
Fighting New Mexico.
You can have that one for free for your little radio station, Ben.
Stations.
that is in my house only a rumor at this point.
Oh goodness. Yeah. Well, let's see. Is there anything else big that's happened this week? Should we wrap it up? Let people get back to their lives, celebrate.
You know, they're going to name committees in a couple of weeks. It looks like they're going to probably do that, or they're trying to do that.
Sooner rather than later. Yeah.
They're trying to do it before the end of the month. They're going to take a few days off here, watch the president get inaugurated, and come back next week.
Either cheer or throw stuff at the TV.
Right, you know, right. alternate depending on their, you know, where they are. And the session hadn't really started. It'll really start when we get the committees going. And
you know, don't have any emergency items yet. We have the governor's state of the state.
That's actually sort
that's
of
on the 29th.
Thing,
right?
The governor's state of the state in 2 weeks. We'll see about that.
The governor is hinting that he might not have emergency items.
Everything's good.
No emergencies.
We're great.
I don't completely buy this, but you know, there's a 2-month period at the beginning of the session where the legislature can't consider anything except what the governor declares an emergency. It doesn't have to be an emergency.
I think we should put out.
It's an open thing for the governor.
We should put out a call to the general public. What do you think should be an emergency item?
Oh my God!
The Astros.
The Texans, maybe. Anything from Houston that calls itself a sports team.
No place to eat lunch on the north end of Congress Avenue. You know?
Oh, I know. Isn't that horrible?
It's horrible. That's a real emergency.
That actually is.
Is that a hashtag first world problem?
That's within the next 30 minutes.
If Rick Perry would put the reopening of Las Manitas on the emergency items list.
I'd be behind that.
I'd quit the Tribune and go raise money for it.
Wow.
He's hungry. He does. I guess we could throw that in just real quickly. He may need to raise some money.
Oh, the Abbott versus Perry thing?
Yeah.
Not Las Manitas.
Oh, yeah, that.
Yeah.
Not Las Manitas, yeah. Well, Greg Abbott is in position now with $18 million in the bank to run a Republican primary for governor without asking for another dollar.
Or to buy an elephant for Harold Cook.
Oh, yeah.
As I saw today. Or two.
Or two.
Right.
So the question now is not whether Abbott runs for governor, but if he doesn't run for governor with $18 million in his pocket,
what's he going to do?
Why not? What the heck? What'd you raise all that money for?
Well, there's not a Senate spot available unless Cornyn's looking to retire.
What could he use the money for? He could hire a limousine encased in gold.
He could start Las Manitas back up for Evan Smith.
He could hire a limousine encased in gold to deliver his next lawsuit against the federal government. I think we ought to start like Greg Abbott's $18 million as a fake Twitter feed.
Start wearing white suits and dress like Tom Wolfe.
Seriously, Greg Abbott's monocle. I know. Look. Brad Watson reported since the last time we were on this podcast. Brad Watson reported in what I would with WFAA affection for Brad Dallas, Watson of WFAA, what I would describe generously as a thinly sourced story.
You sound like Eric Bierce calling it. It's as thin as my raisin toast.
Generously. But we love Brad Watson anyway, because he gave us an opportunity to talk about this, right? that Greg Abbott, according to Watson, Abbott's been telling donors, I'm going to run for governor.
You know, another source told Peggy Feacock the same thing.
Same thing. Right. A lot of us believe that Abbott's going to run for governor, that's not in question. That the only question is whether the governor's going to run for governor.
Right, whether Rick Perry's in that race.
But we're not going to know that definitively for 4 or 5 months.
They both said we're not going to talk about it till June.
Yeah, we're not going to know.
Talk about it.
But the $18 million does present an interesting challenge from Governor Perry's perspective in that whatever Kay Bailey Hutchison had going into the prospect of a 2010 primary shouldn't have $18 million.
Well, the primary between Hutchison and Perry ran about $42 million. So Abbott's about there. So it's about $20 million, $21 million.
But she wasn't where he is now.
No, but she was in a snap your fingers, raise the money state. You know, one of the questions with Perry is going to be this. Having run a really busy expensive gubernatorial race in 2010, and then this presidential race, has he tapped everybody out? I mean, when he knocks on the door and says, you know, hey, baby, can I have some money? They say, you know, look, you were just here.
Who's he calling baby?
I don't know yet. You know, maybe the same people that Greg Abbott's calling baby.
If you know who he's calling baby, maybe you could email us at tribcast at texastribune.org.
Hey, Amon, the podcast is over, apparently.
Or, of course, always, if you have any ideas for how to spend $18 million, you can send that along at tribcast at texastribune.org as well. Thanks for listening. As always, this is Ben with Evan and Amon and Ross Bethija and Todd Bethija over here, our producer. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you next week.
Hello? Good grief.